Good morning. I'm glad to be here and have this opportunity to share some thoughts on the third chapter of Genesis. But before we get to that, I wanted to read through some scriptures that have at least a peripheral significance on that core chapter in the beginning of the Bible. From Genesis, the first chapter, the earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seeds after their kind, and trees bearing fruit with seeds in them after their kind, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of all the earth, and every tree which has fruit yielding seed, it shall be food for you." Then in the third chapter, when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and it was alluring to the eyes, and that the tree was desirable to make one wise, she took from its fruit and ate. She gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they sewed fig leaves together to cover themselves. I think I can fit in one footnote here, that the word that is translated as wise in that verse is the Hebrew word sekel, which does mean intelligence, but it also means craftiness or outsmarting others. The woman anticipates that this forbidden fruit will enhance sekel, and to all appearance, it does so. Humans prefer sekel to wisdom most of the time, and this too reflects human frailty and the condition that we are in. Ironically, the woman had been outsmarted by the sekel of the snake, but she gets some revenge in the following verse. In the Apocrypha, in the book of 2 Esdras, there is a short verse that caught my attention. "Because of the desert heat," God said, "I clothed you with the leaves of the trees." Now in the ninth chapter of Genesis, after leaving the ark, Noah began farming and he planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk. In Genesis chapter 30, "Now in the days of wheat harvest, Reuben went and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, 'Please give me some of your son's mandrakes.' Then God remembered Rachel, and God gave heed to her and opened her womb. So she conceived and bore a son and said, 'God has taken away my reproach.' She named him Joseph, saying, 'May the Lord give me another son.'" Now, in this verse, the word that is translated as mandrakes is the Hebrew word dudaim, which refers to a plant that is no longer identifiable. However, it was perceived to enhance female fertility and probably has nothing to do with the European plant called mandrake. In Psalm 1, verse 3, the psalmist says, "The righteous person will be like a tree firmly planted by a stream of water, which yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither." And in the book of Revelations, in the very last chapter, we have a description of the tree of life. "On either side of the river is the tree of life, with its 12 kinds of fruit, producing its fruit each month, and the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations," which verse you probably recognize from the song we just sang. Now, I was assuming that there would be children here, and you'll see why that was important to the sermon in a minute, but since there are no children, we don't need to ask them to leave. So the sermon itself begins now. Blaise Pascal is credited with saying, "If I had more time, I would have written you a shorter letter." That adage probably applies to this sermon as well. but I am attempting here to make a new interpretation of the single most contentious passage in the entire Bible, the third chapter of Genesis. So bear with me if I exceed my optimum length of 15 minutes, and recall that not so long ago, sermons lasted for an hour, sometimes 2 or 3 hours. By those historical standards, this will be brief. I had first intended to begin a series of messages on John Calvin today, but I had a new insight on how to approach that convoluted topic. Just as I began the series on Martin Luther with the first chapter of Genesis, I thought it would be fitting to begin a series on Calvin with the third chapter of Genesis, the account of the snake and the forbidden fruit in the Garden of Eden. Perhaps no one has been more invested in the third chapter of Genesis than was John Calvin. Hence, it is an apt place to begin a series of commentary on this great reformer from Geneva. Yet, at the same time, I also thought that the third chapter of Genesis would be a little harsh to read with children in the room. So instead, I collected a series of Bible verses that illustrate the alluring power of plants. These verses start in the first chapter of Genesis and go to the very last chapter of Revelations. One verse that shows the power of plants is Noah's vineyard, which he plants soon after leaving the ark, and which leads him into some dark escapades involving his grandson. If the generation following the flood represents God's second attempt at creation, then that passage about Noah's vineyard is a reprise of the third chapter of Genesis. But more on this later. Now that the children who aren't here have left the room, perhaps we can focus on the explanation of human depravity offered in the third chapter of Genesis. While you might suspect that I have some doubts about the usual interpretation of this chapter, I can assure you that I have no doubt about the depth of human depravity, including my own. Quakers who presume that of God in everyone without exploring the depths of that ocean of darkness that wells up in the human heart are sadly deluded. But also, those secular groups that trust in the natural capacity of the proletariat to generate a communist utopia are also under a greater delusion. But even more so, those Christians and economists who believe that an invisible hand regulates the gears of capitalism to generate a benevolent economy, if only the government does not interfere with those fragile market forces, these too are very likely the most deluded and dangerous group in our world today. So yes, we live in perilous times, operating both within us as individuals and in the social settings we live in. The third chapter of Genesis is the ancient attempt to explain the dire situations in which we find ourselves. Hence, it deserves careful and thoughtful consideration. As is often the case, we will find that examining the Hebrew text offers new and compelling interpretations of this familiar story. As you know, the first chapter of Genesis offers one account of creation based upon the 6 days of creation culminating in the Sabbath rest on the seventh day. In contrast, the second chapter of Genesis offers an entirely different and probably older account of creation that involves molding Adam from the dust of the earth, invigorating Adam by the breath of God, and later extracting a woman from the rib cage of an anesthetized Adam to produce a servant and a spouse for him. Together, they represent the parents of all humankind. However, in the third chapter of Genesis, the rubber meets the road and history shifts from idol to odyssey. The talking snake appears to charm the woman. She does not actually receive the Hebrew name of Chava until the end of chapter 3, which we translate as Eve, but her life is already changed, but after her life has already changed dramatically. Rather than a snake charmer, we have instead a charming snake, the most subtle of creatures, as the KJV puts it. This snake questions the woman, leading her to doubt God's prohibition on eating a particular fruit produced by the tree of the knowledge of good and bad. After the snake draws attention to this tree, its fruit becomes alluring, enticing, and irresistible to the woman, and she eats it, as does Adam. Oddly enough, neither the woman nor Adam remark on the flavor of this fruit. Perhaps it was a disappointment. Moreover, the promised knowledge of good and bad is similarly rather modest. In fact, it was primarily a sense of immodesty, the awareness of their nakedness. However, the Hebrew word for nakedness, arum, also means vulnerable. Their first response to nakedness is to fashion a sort of loincloth from fig leaves. God soon comes along to inquire about their new wardrobe. And Adam replies that this woman you gave me, she offered me fruit from the tree and I ate it. Adam implies that God was at fault here for creating a woman rather than for anything that Adam had done. This retort shows that the vaunted fruit of knowledge failed to impart much insight, much less knowledge of good or bad, at least in the short term. But Adam does have a point here. Why did God place a booby trap in the Garden of Eden? It sounds like giving Pandora a box with the instructions never to open it. Many fables involve a tantalizing prohibition. Never look in the closet. Never open the book of magical incantations. Never climb the tower. And we know that such prohibitions always prove irresistible for human curiosity. Even the Church of Rome insisted for centuries, never open the Bible on pain of death. But as we know, that prohibition failed as well and led to the Reformation. But is Genesis 3 just another version of the tantalizing prohibition? If so, it hardly seems enough to sustain a theological structure that has lasted for over 2,000 years. What else could be going on here? The Hebrew text takes an unexpected twist, because in the Hebrew, Adam does not actually say, "And I ate it." Instead, Adam says, "And I will eat it." In fact, both Adam and the woman use the same verb, va ohel, as they separately reply to God's interrogation. According to Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler of the 20th century, Adam and the woman recognize that they cannot stop eating the forbidden fruit. They say to God, "I ate it and I will eat it." Is this because they are obstinate, or because they recognize that they are overwhelmed by the effect of this fruit? Dessler favors the second interpretation. Once they have tasted the fruit, they cannot resist it. They make a realistic assessment and truthfully admit to God that given the opportunity, they will eat the forbidden fruit again and again. Is this simply another version of the tantalizing prohibition? Perhaps not. The fruit was not particularly tasty, but it must have had some amazing effects, just as wine had a notorious effect on Noah after he left the ark. Well, it would be easy to jump to the conclusion that the forbidden fruit is simply sex. Plain and simple. Look no further. Sigmund Freud has explained everything. However, there are some points against this presumption. First is that in chapter 2, there is strong textual evidence that Adam and his woman were already engaging in sex before they encountered the talking snake. As soon as Adam recovers from his anesthesia, the text says, "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and cling to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. They were both naked, Adam and his woman, and they were not ashamed." This is pretty explicit acknowledgement that sex was immediately available to Adam as soon as he sees his woman. Moreover, there is evidence in the Hebrew text that both Cain and Abel were born in the Garden of Eden before they ate the forbidden fruit. Hence, there is no suggestion in the Hebrew that sex itself was either the cause of expulsion from Eden, nor that the forbidden fruit was a metaphor for sex. At the same time, there are abundant suggestions in the text that something of a sexual nature took place between Adam and his woman after eating the fruit. First, there is a snake, both a phallic symbol and a sign of danger. Then there is the sudden preoccupation with nakedness and immodesty immediately following the incident of eating the fruit. Finally, there is the curse of painful childbirth as a punishment for the crime. At this point, let me suggest that the reason that this passage of the Bible has wrought so much ambiguity and mystery over the millennia lies not in the framework of the story itself, but in limitations of the reader's frame of reference. The framework of the story, as it was crafted and redacted in the 4th century BCE, emphasizes disobedience as the essential sin that merits punishment from an angry but patient God. That is a worthy message in its own right, particularly in the historical context of the 4th century BCE, where the Jews were returning from Babylon to Jerusalem. However, it places God himself in a naked and vulnerable situation if God planted a booby trap in Eden merely to trick Adam and his spouse into disobedience. Evidently, God did not know his human creation nearly as well as he thought he did. The first human couple fails at its first serious test and has never fully recovered. Moreover, God expels the couple from Eden, ostensibly to prevent them from gaining immortality in their defective state. What kind of God is this? In a modern era of informed consent, what would it take for Adam to understand death before Adam had witnessed death? What, in fact, does accountability for sin mean without some prior experience of sin? Let me suggest that another metaphor could be operating in this story of the forbidden fruit, a metaphor that represents entheogens. Entheogens are plants with extraordinary powers that induce perceptions of divinity, inexplicable peace and tranquility, or a sense of amazement at the experience of life. Entheogens include psilocybin, ayahuasca, and opium. Some people would include LSD and cannabis as examples of entheogens. These plants are typically hard to find, somewhat forbidden and forbidding, and subject to punishment when they are used. They are most closely associated with shamanism. In fact, a bundle of cannabis was recently found in what appears to be a shaman's grave in Central Asia. Now, lest you think that I am planning to advocate the use of entheogens, I am not. There are perfectly good reasons to avoid them, and the third chapter of Genesis provides a framework for understanding that prohibition. If my conjecture is correct, the writer of Genesis is saying, don't mess with entheogens unless you are prepared to pay a price. But even so, entheogens are part of creation as we know it, and presumably they are included in the broad judgment in the first chapter of Genesis that says all seed-bearing plants are good and that they are suitable for food. So entheogens may have a valid use, but they can also be misused. They may be addictive. They may pose risks to sanity in vulnerable individuals. Moreover, no one knows in advance just how they will react to an entheogen. We are all of us, after all, naked and quite vulnerable beneath our clothing. Now, is this all that Genesis 3 is saying? No, that's not my point. The conventional interpretation of this chapter is still relevant, and in fact, it is necessary within the context of the Bible as a whole. But for this era in which we now live in, when entheogens are known, talked about, and often readily available, this chapter could have new meaning and relevance that was not available to previous generations of Jewish and Christian interpreters who lived in more innocent times. Not until the 20th century did the knowledge of entheogens return. It had been suppressed along with the practices of shamanism and witchcraft during the Middle Ages for over a millennium. While I do not want to overinterpret my conjecture, I do want to provide a few more details. From a shamanic perspective, a talking snake is not surprising. Many shamans report receiving information about psychoactive plants from animals. Sometimes this is as mundane as watching a squirrel eating maple leaves in the early spring and thereby discovering the sweet sap of the maple tree. Sometimes it is a talking animal that directs the shaman to a particular plant with instructions on how to use it or combine it with other plants, as in making ayahuasca. Again, I am not advocating the use of shamanic rituals or plants. I am simply reporting that creation is more mysterious than we commonly assume. Animals may know more than we ordinarily suspect, and we humans are more vulnerable or naked than we might like to think. So, in particular regard to the legalization of cannabis, or the prescription of opiates such as Percocet, or illegal stimulants such as cocaine, anything that causes us to feel better temporarily will also cause us to feel worse when it wears off. Pain medications can generate paradoxical pain when sustained use at too large a dose. This is a direct effect of how these substances work in the nervous system. They release neurotransmitters, they bind to receptors, and after their effect ends, we are depleted for a while of those same neurotransmitters. This is typically a zero-sum game and often a lose-lose in the long run, particularly if repeated use leads to addiction. However, there are exceptions to this general rule. Antidepressants, which do not cause euphoria, can relieve depression without major risk of worsening depression. That's a complex topic, and I don't want to go into details, but I want to make a distinction between entheogens and certain prescription medication. Moreover, a lot of recreational drugs lead to alterations in sexual perception and behavior. Perhaps this is what caused Adam and Eve to sow leaf figs together to cover their shame. Fig leaves, I'm sorry. Perhaps they stumbled onto an entheogen that changed the way they experienced intimacy. Maybe it was the fermented grapes that Noah enjoyed. Perhaps it was another fruit, such as dudaim, that we now know nothing about. In any event, they experienced a vivid, life-transforming, irresistible, and somewhat regrettable experience. Part of that experience elevated their sensory perceptions, but then there was a subsequent fall. The fall was so profound that it changed the self-perception of Adam and his offspring throughout history. This was no mere intoxication. It was intoxication followed by a sobering insight. It was the knowledge of good and bad, after all, the first step to self-knowledge. This encounter with entheogens probably led our forebears to a more realistic appraisal of what it means to be human. Specifically, I ate, and given the opportunity, I will eat again. And yet this realization itself produces profound ambivalence because it calls into question human agency. Who is in charge, after all, me or the forbidden and alluring fruit? This loss of agency feels like, and is, a fall from grace. It produces profound self-doubt. Yet it is also an essential aspect of self-knowledge. Our theology tells us that the curse of working by the sweat of our brow is a punishment from God for Adam's disobedience in the Garden of Eden. But rather than a curse, we might view work as the opportunity to do something creative, to relieve the boredom of intoxication. If we realize that a few milligrams of THC in cannabis can produce a sweet sense of satisfaction without any demonstrable effort, we might be seriously tempted to maintain that blissful condition for as long as we could. That, of course, is a step toward addiction, although not everyone who uses cannabis or opium reaches an overt stage of addiction. But even without that risk, we should recall that meaningful achievement requires persistent frustration and unhappiness in our lives. One must struggle with an obstacle in order to overcome it. The Quaker founder William Penn wrote a book entitled No Cross, No Crown to illustrate that point. Thus, we should become more willing to tolerate frustration rather than seek the solace of alcohol or the contentment produced by cannabis. If nothing else, it does not seem fair to those who struggle with deprivation if we live in perpetual peace and artificial contentment. We will be both more motivated and more capable if we learn to treasure dissatisfaction as a God-given gift, which is necessary for personal transformation and social betterment. This is another important message hidden in the third chapter of Genesis. Moreover, a more cautionary consideration, pay attention. A more cautionary consideration is that plants are only one source of excessive contentment that can lead to apathy and indifference. Any form of self-indulgence or distraction can do the same thing, whether it is music, exercise, or computer games. This perspective is part and parcel of the English Reformation that we associate with Puritanism. Quakers both internalized and rejected various aspects of Puritanism in the 16th century. Hopefully, we will soon get to that topic and examine their ambiguity in greater detail. But first, we will need to explore the writings of John Calvin in upcoming messages.